I had a whale actually touch my boat. I was rowing near Hibernia one morning, about 9 a.m. It was a gray, kind of somber, cool day, like most days are in the North Atlantic. And suddenly I was covered in whale snot from a whale right beside me. You can imagine the startle factor there, but I looked down and there is a whale's eyeball looking at me. I was looking at it. It just dove, rose up in front of my boat, went down again, and as it went down, its tail contacted the front of my boat just unintentionally, and yeah, super special.
That's Laval Saint-Germain, RCGS fellow and extreme adventurer. He's rowed solo across the Atlantic Ocean, is the only Canadian to have summited Mount Everest without oxygen. He's also climbed the tallest peaks on all seven continents, including Antarctica, and many more remote and challenging mountains besides. He's also a commercial pilot in the Canadian Arctic. His list of accomplishments are long, which is why we're thrilled to have him as our guest here on Explore, a Canadian Geographic podcast. Welcome to all you explorers out there, armchair and in motion. I'm your host, David MacGuffin. That is the sound of otherwise sensible people plunging into freezing cold water across Canada. We held our annual RCGS Polar Plunge last week to support another season of this podcast. And thanks to all of our amazing plungers and donors like you, we not only hit our goal of $35,000, we crushed it, topping $50,000, our most successful polar plunge ever. This was mostly done in the best grassroots way possible. Lots of donations from lots of you out there. We did get five significant donations too, and I want to thank those donors individually here. Dr. Ian Hammond's donation helped compel RCGS CEO John Geiger to jump into a freezing Lake Ontario. Connor Fitzgerald's donation got RCGS fellow and polar filmmaker Mark Carey to jump into that same Great Lake. And Nancy Love's generous donation got RCGS Vice President Sarah Legault to follow John and Mark screaming into Lake Ontario too. And I had two donors who got me to lead the plunge into a chilly Meech Lake in the Gatineau Hills. One is my mother, Lynn MacGuffin, an RCGS Campsel Award winner, and also my big cousin, Lynn Evenson. Thank you all so much. I also want to single out our top three fundraisers, all of whom win a fantastic Danish cold water swim coat from our sponsor, Sitting Suits. Congratulations to James Raffin, Susan Eaton, and Mark Terry, all of whom fittingly spend a lot of time working and even living in our polar regions. Thanks also to the dozens of RCGS fellows and friends of Canadian Geographic who took part from coast to coast to coast. There were 11 plunge sites in all this year. And of course, thanks also to all of you who donated. I am very humbled to be a part of this incredible community, so connected to nature, and to be bringing you another season of Explore. So, on to Laval Saint-Germain. Laval led our polar plunge in Calgary, RCGS toque on his head, and he has many great stories to tell, so let's get right to it. Laval Saint-Germain, thanks so much for coming on the Explore podcast.
Thanks for having me, David. I'm flattered.
No, I feel like it's been a long time coming. You've definitely been on our radar, and you've done so many incredible things. You're really a perfect fit. I'd love to dive into a few of those things.
Sure.
But the thing I always love to get into first with our explorers is where that spark of adventure came from. And I'm just curious about, you know, what your parents were getting you up to as a kid and where you grew up and what that experience was.
Yeah, I grew up in a small farming community north of Edmonton, Alberta. It was called Morinville, Bonneville. So very small town. My French roots go back there probably about 120 years or so. My ancestors came from Quebec. There are three areas of French Canadians in Alberta. They're all north of Edmonton, one to the northeast, one's directly to the north, and one up in the Peace River country, if you know where that is, up in northwestern Alberta. So I came from one of those communities. And our town at the time was surrounded by German farmers. So my mom is from a German farm family. My dad was a townie, so to speak, from Morinville. And the way I got into this stuff is National Geographic and reading books, things like Farley Mowat, Jack London, Tarzan, all the typical books, I think, that we used to read back in the day before we had these things.
Ruined reading the smartphone, yeah.
It has. And I think I did a lot of dreaming and imagining and traveling, so to speak, through the pages of those books. And my dad was always into the outdoors, but more so in the sense of canoeing and hunting and fishing and that type of stuff. But we were a skiing family, so we spent a lot of time skiing as well.
Downhill and cross country, or what was that?
Mainly downhill, and then it turned when I was a teenager, I got into the backcountry skiing for sure.
Yeah.
So I think seeing what were the pages of National Geographic and these books that I mentioned really spurred my interest in traveling and seeing the world.
Yeah.
Looking at a map to me was one of the most exciting things, and leafing through the pages of the World Book Encyclopedia was incredible. And I think my parents just, they just promoted that.
Can I just go back to maps too? Because I have a whole thing about maps. And the smartphone, I think, has also kind of ruined maps and GPSs and all that. But just that that laying out a paper map on a table and just tracing the lines of where you want to go or where you think you're going to go, or just the imagination that's sparked from that, it still makes me, it gives me tingles, you know, like.
Yeah, the imagination part, I think, is the key word there, David, in the sense that I remember recently, not recently, but 10 years ago, I was planning a climbing trip in Kurdistan in northern Iraq, and I did a lot of research on it, and I was using Google Earth to look at my route, and I had zoomed in very close on this sort of this 4x4 track in the mountains of Kurdistan, and several weeks later, I was standing on that spot and I had recognized it because I'd already seen the view from Google Earth. And it kind of, in a sense, it fascinated me how precise it was, but it also kind of wrecked it because I'd already been there digitally.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've got pros and cons of technology for sure. But yeah, maps are, I mean, to unfold a map and plan an expedition is probably, to me, one of the best things.
Yeah. So hunting and fishing with your dad, I mean, so there were canoe trips involved, the camping and all that?
Yeah. Sort of the typical northern Alberta activities that we did, moose hunting and canoeing, skiing at the small little hills up in northern Alberta.
Yeah.
And then that turned into... you know, looking further afield as I got into the airline business. I became a pilot, started training when I was very young. And the reason I did that is my dad said, if you wanted to go to all these places, then become a pilot.
Yeah.
And then I became a bush pilot, and I was, you know, sort of the iconic Canadian idea of a bush pilot where I'm flying around in a beaver on floats with the round engine, the radial engine.
And, oh, amazing.
And northern Quebec and northern BC. And it was just, it was... I was lucky. I had an adventurous life for sure at the beginning of my life, and I think that set the stage.
Yeah, there's nothing better than both takeoff and landing on a float plane and a beaver specifically. What a rush!
Well, if you've seen northern Canada, the world is your landing strip. There's airplanes. There's places to land everywhere. Millions of them.
Exactly. So your dad. I mean, that's a very wise piece of advice. And I went into journalism for pretty much the same reason. It's like, you can find a career that somebody will pay you to go to amazing places, like sign up.
Yeah, exactly. So thankfully he did that. It's always intriguing though, as an adult, when you look back at the decisions that your parents made or the advice that they gave you, how incredibly important it is and how it can change the trajectory of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And that really did. I want to get in. I mean, you've done so many things, but I was listening to your podcast, with the Adventure Audio podcast, which I recommend people to check out.
Thanks for plugging that, David. Thanks for plugging it.
No problem. We got to help each other here in the podcasting world. The episode I just listened to was you and you've got this deal where you've climbed all the highest peaks in all seven continents. That's right. Yeah. Now,
correct. Yeah.
Having done that, you're now working on the highest peaks in the countries of the world. Is that accurate?
No, not really. It's not one of my goals, but I do definitely, when I get to a place, I want to, I may hide around the corner from my wife and figure out where the highest peak is and figure out a way to get up there. So, yeah. So I think I've got 30 done.
So you're doing the challenging ones, right? So Uganda and Congo, Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, which I spent 6 years in Nairobi as a reporter for CBC. Spent a lot of time in that area. So I'm just fascinated to listen to that. And I mean, what was it that stood out to you about climbing peaks in that part of the world?
Yeah, well, it's a magical place. I don't know if you've been there, but the Rwenzori Mountains, also known as the Mountains of the Moon, are fairly high. They get up to about just under 6,000 meters. And they start off in steaming tropical jungle, where quite literally there's monkeys leaping above your head as you start the trek. And it finishes off in an alpine, Arctic-like environment at the summit. So you go through all these life zones.
Yep.
And what's most unique about the Rwenzori's is that you are wearing rubber boots at about 4,500 meters above sea level. You're wearing rubber boots almost continuously because there's mud all the way up there.
No way.
Until sort of the summit day.
I mean, that sounds like blisters. Hiking in rubber boots is,
It would be, but I'm pretty good at foot care because of all my trips over the years, and I didn't have any rubber boots, but it does sound awful. It sounds like your feet would be completely sweating and chafed, and it wasn't that bad, but it was more like being dressed for moose hunting than it was for alpine climbing.
Yeah.
Eventually, though, as you get to the final camp, you switch into your alpine gear, and you're on crampons and ice axe and all that stuff. You're on snow and ice, but really an amazing glaciated area for Africa, which is now fast disappearing. Yeah. So other than Kilimanjaro and some ice on Kenya, these are the only glaciated peaks in Africa. So what's really outstanding about it, Dave, is that you're standing on top of these glaciated peaks looking down into the Congo or looking down into the jungles of Uganda, which is such a contrast. And when we think about the Congo, we think about green jungle. We don't think about standing on snow and ice and actually being cold. And so, I think what climbing in these areas does is it gets you to the most remote areas, and it really gets you into the backcountry of these areas, where I think you see the true pulse of a country. And so the Rwenzori's are very unique. Yeah, and there's even a very tiny population, a subspecies of leopard up there called the Rwenzori leopard. Wow. And the locals call it a snow leopard. They would not refer to it as a leopard. They would refer to it as a snow leopard. And I said, what do you mean by that? You know, it's obviously not a snow leopard. And they said, no, the one that I saw was white, for example, but not me, but one of our the local Ugandans we were climbing with. And it was dead, though, and I think it was probably bleached. The fur is probably bleached by the sun, the one that he saw, because any reports of these never before photographed and never videoed leopards are darker color, but they live up in the snow and they hunt at very high altitudes in the Rwenzori Mountains. So it's just not what you think about Africa at all. It's quite a unique environment.
Amazing. It's just a beautiful sort of hidden part of the world there, and partly hidden because it's especially the Eastern Congo that's a dangerous place. I mean, there's been a pretty much low level insurrection going on there for 20 years. Like, how did you manage that?
We had a minimum of two Kalashnikov carrying rangers with us at all times. And a month before we arrived there, in a nearby area, probably about an hour drive away, there were two tourists that were killed in their camp, not in the Rwenzori's, but near the Rwenzori's. So the country was on edge in the area now, or when we were there, which was in December, it's a not recommended for travel area for sure. So there are some incursions of Congolese guerrillas that will penetrate into Uganda and then skirt back across the border. And although the people that were killed were killed by a Tanzanian group, which is unusual, a ragtag group of terrorists.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of tragic because it is, as you say, just the beautiful and just, I mean, the jungle is sort of the stereotypical part of it, but there's just the levels and depths of green on green on green. There is just, you know, like,
yeah. And the wildlife you see, not so much big game, but the bird life was quite incredible. But Africa has a lot to offer.
It's a wonderful place. In your podcast, you were singling out the porters. I think it may have been on the Congolese side, but maybe both. But just how incredible they were, including some women that you were climbing with.
Yeah, and I'd seen that before. So the Ugandan porters, they were fairly small. They wore the worst footwear, usually torn up rubber boots. They wore jeans. We had our technical gear on. We had our wicking socks. We had our merino base layers. We had the typical sort of 21st century Western climbing garb on. And these guys, these women were just wearing ragged t-shirts. And it was cold. It was very cold. It would go, you know, at the bottom of the mountain, it was warm, but within a couple of days, it was quite cold and it stayed quite chilly most of the time. Like, wearing pants was quite normal. And then you'd had all your down on in the at night. and they would just wear rags, and they would quite often be able to keep up with us carrying heavy loads, and not on their back in the traditional sense, but on their head. They would carry, you know, technical backpacks on their head or duffel bags. And not just a single duffel bag, but they'd have duffel bags stuffed into coffee bags, like the canvas coffee bags or the knit coffee bags, with other gear on top of that. And I saw this as well in Irian Jaya. It's now called Papua, the Papua province of Indonesia. I was climbing there. And we had porters there. And there were some women porters who were carrying heavy, heavy gear and their babies at the same time on what's purportedly the toughest hike on earth, with no shoes, all barefoot. And, you know, a 7-day hike barefoot through the jungle and then up into mountains that look like Kananaskis country in Alberta, all limestone, rough, sharp rocks with bare feet. So tough people. Tough people.
Amazing. And good of you to give them that shout out, right? Because these are often the forgotten equation in these expeditions, and they're absolutely essential, right? Like, these things aren't
It's easy to frame an expedition or frame a narrative or frame a photo where those people are cut out, and they're the ones that are doing the really hard work.
Yeah.
It's a huge part of the economy there. It's a necessary part of the economy. And it's a great opportunity to also preserve the countryside that we're climbing in because of the tourist activity. But you've got to shout out, you've got to show people the true story, not just the stuff you see on Instagram where you look like a hero.
I want to dive into a bit of the things you've done, and this the ones that sort of pique my interest. To start with, rowing across the Atlantic. I think, like a lot of people, my relationship with the Atlantic is I definitely have swum in the Atlantic, you know, on both sides of it. And I've, you know, flown over it many, many times. But I mean, you rode solo across it. And what intrigues me about that is for centuries, our relationship with the Atlantic was that it was a means of transport primarily, right? Like, and I'm just wondering what that experience was. First of all, just to be out on that, doing that on your own.
It was something really special, something very terrifying, something very challenging. Psychologically, it was difficult to shove off that dock in Halifax, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I had done all the work I could do to prepare for it. I'm an Alberta boy, and I know nothing about the ocean. I know lots about weather because I'm a pilot. My only ocean experience had been my wife and I and our kids doing a 7-day sea kayaking trip through the Queen Charlotte Islands. That was it. Mm. And being on a ferry from Prince Rupert to Charlotte City. That's all my experience on the ocean. And until I got into that boat and shoved off. And the impetus for the trip, David, was a friend of mine had been diagnosed with cancer, and my fellow pilots at Canadian North Airlines. And he was a 40-year-old guy. I'm speaking him in the past tense, but he's still doing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
He was a 40-year-old guy with a very young family and suddenly healthy guy. Nothing in his lifestyle that would indicate something like this would occur. And he suddenly was diagnosed with cancer. And to me, it would be like... the analogy I use with that, you go into a doctor's office, he opens the back door of the office in his lab coat and walks you down to a dock and says, get in that boat. You've got about 100 days. You've got to row to France. You're going to be sick from the chemo, like I was sick from the seasickness. You're going to be cold and lonely from the treatment, just like I was. You're going to lose weight. You're going to be tired. You're going to be uncomfortable. And even though I'm surrounded by electronics where I can communicate with my family, just like you are in the hospital if you have an illness, you're surrounded by your friends. You're still alone in that battle, either with cancer or with this crossing. And then I used that as the notoriety of the trip to raise money for the Alberta Cancer Foundation. So when I got down to that dock on June 15th of 2016 at 5:45 in the morning and shoved off, I knew I was in for a real battle. I mean, we know what the weather's like in the North Atlantic. Mm-hmm. I wasn't doing the traditional crossing of the Atlantic, which is from the Canaries to the Caribbean. I was going on a route that doesn't get done often in a solo ocean rowing boat. It was scary, but you know, humans can adapt. And I saw some spectacular things. I had some pure Canadiana moments out there. I was rowing through the Hibernia Offshore Oil Project. And there are these no-go zones around the platforms that boats are not allowed in. And being a real following Canadian, I did not want to cross these lines, lines on your map. And we're back to maps again.
Yeah.
And there was a storm blowing, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning. And one of the radio operators in one of these oil platforms made contact with me. And you're always on the same channel. It's an emergency channel out at sea. And we had this long conversation. He was a Newfoundlander that was working on the oil rigs offshore in Newfoundland. But in the winter times, he was working in northeastern Alberta. And specifically in an oil sands mine called Horizon, and that's where we do all the flying of the workers in and out of Horizon for Canadian Natural Resources. My airline does that. So he had been on my flights for sure. And we just had this conversation about Tim Hortons. We had this conversation because I wanted some coffee out there. We talked about our families. We talked about sort of his migratory life of living in Newfoundland for part of the year and then Alberta for part of the year. And it was really special. I was in that storm. I was scared. I was alone. And I had this contact with another guy, which was pretty special. So I had moments like that. I had some Spanish fishermen who called me up on the radio. They spoke a little English. I spoke a little Spanish. And we had the same type of conversation, just both two little boats bobbing out in the middle of the Atlantic. So yeah. It was a magical place. And surrounded by wildlife, I was shocked at how many dolphins are out in the North Atlantic. Without a word of a lie, I bet you I saw over 2,000 dolphins. Wow. And whales. I had a whale actually touch my boat. Interesting story in that, I was rowing near Hibernia one morning, about 9 a.m. There was a gray, kind of somber, cool day, and like most days are in the North Atlantic. And suddenly I was covered in whale snot and air from a whale blowing its blowhole 60 centimeters off my elbow, right beside me. You can imagine the startle factor there, but I looked down and there was a whale's eyeball looking at me. I was looking at it.
No way.
We were just looking at each other, making a decision about what was going to happen here. And it just dove, rose up in front of my boat, went down again. And as it went down, its tail contacted the front of my boat just unintentionally. And yeah, super special to have, fellow mammals out there, whether it's whales or dolphins.
What a connection.
Amazing. Yeah. Just an amazing.
Is whale snot pretty much like human snot? What's that?
just larger. You can roll it into bigger balls. Yeah. Well, it was something special. And it's something I'm never going to forget. And you know, when you're in a storm in a little tiny boat, my boat was about just over six meters long and about 1.4 meters across. When you're in a storm with 8 or 10 meter high waves, it's pretty terrifying, especially at night. But I had a really well built boat, and like I keep saying, that people are adaptable.
Tell us about the boat. How big and
what's it's made by a company in the UK called Rannoch Adventures. Mm-hmm. So it's all fiberglass, and it's got a little cockpit in the front to be sort of like climbing under your kitchen table with a door on it. So it's a very small area. Mm-hmm. I had a sleeping bag in there and a mat that I was sleeping on the floor, and then all my gear was stored in there. Mm-hmm. My food was stored in different areas of the boat, at the bottom of the boat, to weigh it down so that it wouldn't tip easily, mm-hmm. and keep it more stable. This thing had solar panels on it to power my electronics. So I had all the electronics you would need to sail across the ocean, for example. Yeah. So I could see other aircraft coming or other boats coming, for example. I could receive weather information from my wind, weather, and waves guy in Calgary, a guy named Jim Redeker. He would provide me with, the upcoming weather and storms and that type of thing, and how long they would last. And then I had satellite tracking and communication. The cockpit had a water steel door, so I could lock it right down in big storms, because in big storms, the boat was completely submerged in waves at times.
Wow.
And the boat was designed to roll 360 degrees and right itself. Nice. So I didn't actually do a complete 360, but I did a lot of probably 200-degree dips where I was under the water, and then it would roll back upwards, but never went all the way around. So really, really well-designed boat. And it even had an autopilot system. which I didn't use after a while because it took so much battery power to run the autopilot, mm-hmm. meaning that I would put a heading in and it would try to maintain that heading by operating the rudder. I had a rudder that I could operate with my hands or the autopilot. So a really advanced little piece of kit.
Amazing. What's a typical day like out there? What was that like?
Well, there isn't really a typical day. It all depended on the weather. Mm-hmm. So if you had good weather, you could row all day right till nighttime. If the weather started to blow, then you'd be rowing until you couldn't row anymore because of the wave height. So you'd be rowing, and then all of a sudden you would stump your oar into a wave that's on your right that may be 6 feet high, and one you're 6 feet above the one on your left, for example, and pretty soon you're unable to row. So I'd stow my oars and then jump in the cockpit and then continue to drift if the wind was in the right direction. If the wind was in the wrong direction, I would put a para anchor out, which is a massive underwater parachute. I had it on 111 meters of rope, so a large coil of rope, and I would drop that into the sea. It would drag out. It was attached to the bow of the boat, and it would inflate under the water, just like a massive drag chute on a drag car, mm-hmm. when you see them stop or when you see them break. And that thing would sit several meters under the ocean. And of course, because of the wind effect on the boat, the wind would be blowing the boat across the top of the sea, but subsurface there would be no wind. So the drag from that parachute would really slow me down. So I could be in a big storm and only be moving at a couple of knots in the wrong direction.
Wow. I mean, when you're in a storm like that, where you can't row anymore and you're doing 200 degree turns, tilts. And I mean, how do you keep your nerve?
I think my training as an airline pilot probably helps, mm-hmm. because we are constantly being trained on how to deal with emergencies. Every 6 months you're in the sim and you're trained and you're tested your entire life. Mm. So I think that really helps. And understanding and preparing for these things ahead of time is really important. I had checklists that I made. I had my emergency suit. So my emergency suit I put on if I had to jump into the drink, for example, and my emergency raft are always ready to go. I had flares ready to go. And I also trusted the boat. But the worst thing, David, was at the big storms at night, where you can't see the waves coming. And the trick is that when you go over a 8 meter high wave, is that when you're surfing down the other side, you want to make sure you come down straight so that when you get to the bottom, you don't roll. And at night, you have no visibility. It's like being inside of an inkwell. You can't see anything. So I got so accustomed to the feel of the boat and the way it was running through the water that, weeks into the trip, I was able to feel the boat start to rotate at the top of a wave, because there's a rotational moment at the top of a wave that you don't know if you're from Mooresville, Alberta, and you're not a sailor. And as the boat gets to the top of the wave and there's that white water crest, it causes the boat to turn, and then you come down the wave sideways. So I was able, through just feeling the boat, to steer it with the two little rudder ropes that are attached to the rudder, surf it down the wave straight. I could feel when I was coming down straight versus on an angle. And because of that, I was able to stay up at night during these storms and continuously surf the wave down surf the boat down these large waves. And, sometimes you got it wrong and you'd capsize, and the way I described it then was like being broadsided by a minivan. It felt like you were just suddenly, hit by either a rogue wave or a wave from a different direction, and then the boat would capsize and you would just hang on and hopefully that it would right itself.
Wow. But so it wasn't fun. Literally, that feeling of a jolt, like literally you got sideswiped.
Yeah. Like you would throw you so much so that I had attached a strap system to the bottom of the boat. So in big storms, I would strap myself, my body flat on the bottom of the boat. So I was prone on the bottom of the boat, hanging onto the rudder ropes, and that would keep me from tumbling inside and hitting the ceiling and wrecking gear.
Mm.
Yeah, it wasn't fun.
Yeah. Do you have? I mean, do you have an iPod, or are you listening to music as you do this? Like, what's keeping you?
Yeah, a lot of audiobooks.
Oh, cool.
I had books and audiobooks and podcasts that I had downloaded, and eventually I ran out of those. So I just had my own thoughts. And birds and porpoises to look at, but it was to talk about the storms. It was really interesting. There was a Norwegian ocean rower who had left Manhattan before I'd left Nova Scotia. We ended up simul-crossing the ocean. We were actually, at one time, we were only about 8 nautical miles apart, so call that 12 kilometers apart, mm-hmm. in the middle of the Atlantic. So we were so close that I was actually calling him on the radio, but the range on the radio on these ocean rowing boats is so low because of the wave heights and the fact you're always below the waves, mm-hmm. that I couldn't get a hold of him. But I was hoping that we'd see each other out there. So as we were out in the middle of the North Atlantic, a storm came in, and just the way the storm hit us, it was going to either, we could either go on para anchor, meaning that you would stop the drift across the North Atlantic towards Europe by being on para anchor. But what the para anchor does is it points you into these giant waves safely, so the boat is always nose bow into the waves, mm-hmm. and you would ride out the storm that way. You went on para anchor, or you could run with the storm, where you would point the bow the other direction with no para anchor and let the storm blow you towards France. So I was an inexperienced ocean rower, obviously, and he was a very experienced rower, and he decided that he was going to throw his para anchor out and ride out the storm. So the storm would wash over him, mm-hmm. last a couple of days, but he'd be safe because he'd be always pointed into the waves, and then he was going to come up behind the storm and continue towards Europe. I decided to risk it and run with it, and I had days of horrible, horrible storms, capsizing and being terrified, quite frankly, at night. And but when the storm finally blew past me, I had put on about 250 nautical miles on this Norwegian rower. We weren't racing, but mm-hmm. it had pushed me 250 nautical miles closer to Europe. And then all the subsequent weather systems that hit us on that crossing would kick me towards Europe, but because of his location, would kick him north. And eventually, he had to be rescued way up north, like on the way to Iceland, because he had been so battered, he'd actually broken parts of his boat. So just by about bullshit luck, I ran with the storm, and that put me out of the most dangerous storms that he kept getting hit by, or I would have been in the same boat. Yeah. So I had some good luck. Some beginner's luck for sure, though.
So what's that feeling like when you can look over your shoulder and see France, like, and you're about to pull in?
Yeah, it was something else. It was, I saw a lighthouse first, and then the fog rolled in, and I didn't see anything until I was just a few kilometers from the dock. I was in, like, a pea soup fog. But, it was a strange feeling. It's a really strange feeling to put together a trip that big, on a canvas that big, and to get to the end of it. It's a mixture of elation and feeling a little somber about it, because you know that adventure's over.
Yeah.
Obviously, I was excited to see Janet and the kids and to walk on dry land and have a cold beer and all that stuff and change out of my stinky clothes. But actually, I didn't have that many clothes on. I rode most of the time naked to prevent chafing, but that's a whole different story. it was a feeling, and it's like every time I complete a trip, it's a mixed bag. You're satisfied that you've pulled something off that you dreamt about, but then you're like, what's the next thing?
Yeah, I've talked to other adventurers like yourself who've done long solo skis or to the Antarctic, and they have all mentioned sort of a sadness about losing that time alone too, because you developed this relationship. Mm-hmm. They said with yourself, that you won't have again, in a way, and that's, there's that sort of sadness about letting that go too.
Yeah. And you develop a relationship with the boat. You really develop a relationship with that boat. Mm. My boat was called True Blue, and she kept me alive. And pilots have the same relationship with their airplanes. We give them a feminine name, and we know that, we rely on them, and you start to, I guess, be anthropomorphized the boat. Like in a storm, you're hanging out of the sidewalls as the waves are crashing over you. You're like, hang on, girl. And then I remember when I left her on the dock in Brest, France, I looked down at the boat, and I hadn't looked down at the boat for 2 months because I'd been rowing. And it was such a strange sight to see that my little world that I had lived on for 2 months and survived these storms and these beautiful sunrises and sunsets and dolphins and whales, and that little home, that little ecosystem I lived on was now gone. I was never going to do that again with that little boat. And I remember feeling really somber when I walked away from her, because that's the last time I saw her. I sold her and
ran away.
And that was it. So you do develop this man-machine interface with airplanes and boats, I think, and maybe even bicycles, but I think more so airplanes and boats, because you're actually inside of it and they protect you.
Mm.
That's the way, unintentionally, the way things happen. Yeah.
I'd love to get back to climbing again, because amongst your list of things you've done was you were the first Canadian to climb Everest without support of oxygen, I think. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I'm still the only guy that's done it, the only person that's climbed Canadian. Yep.
Awesome. Well, let's give you that for sure. But what prompted that, and what was that experience like? I mean, that seems like a sure way of killing yourself to me, but yeah.
Well, it's not sure. I wouldn't be sitting here. So Everest was a dream that I had because of an Italian climber named Reinhold Messner. So Reinhold Messner, for the people who don't know him, would be, think of all your greatest 20th century sports stars, roll them into one. Mm-hmm. And for mountaineering, he was that guy. So he was the Wayne Gretzky, the Babe Ruth, the whoever of all sports combined, but for mountaineering. So
when did his career span? Like, what was that?
So that would be in the early 1970s till the 1980s.
Yeah.
So he's from the French-speaking area of Italy, so northern Italy, in the from the mountains. A German-speaking guy, Reinhold Messner. But did I say he's French-speaking? Yeah. I meant German-speaking part of Italy. And he was a superstar, and he wanted to climb Everest without oxygen, which he did with a partner, and then he went back the next year and did it solo, the same route that I was doing. So I read about, once again, it was reading David that brought me there, and I'd read about Reinhold Messner, and I remember thinking, you know, he must be some kind of specimen to be able to do that. But I started to climb. So I climbed all over the world at that point. I'd climbed Denali, I'd climbed Mount Logan in Canada, I'd climbed the big mountains in South America, and Kilimanjaro, and I always did fairly well at altitude, except for one climb in Bolivia. I had altitude sickness. But other than that, I was strong. And so I put it together. I wanted to go from the Tibet side, so you don't have the clown show that you have now on the Nepal side. There were no crowds, there were no lineups, and no queues at the summit or anything like that. And Tibet, to me, was something I always wanted to see, because, frankly, reminds me of Nunavut. It's very similar. The people remind me of the Inuit of Nunavut. The landscape reminds me of Nunavut.
Nice.
And, I put it all together. In December of 2009, I poured my wife two glasses of red wine, and I said, "Hey, babe, I think I'm going to go climb Everest without oxygen." And she said, "It's about time. You're not getting any younger." So I knew
you're the right woman.
I knew I had permission. And I arrived there in March of 2010, and then on May 24th, 2010, I was standing on the top. However, I had not considered that I'd been successful yet, because you have to get down alive, and the descent was probably, it is the most physically difficult thing I've ever done. I was at the point of death for sure, where I was going to lie down in the snow and sleep from exhaustion. I knew I was going to die. I had frozen my right hand, so I ended up losing three fingers on my right hand when I got back to Calgary. But I had decided to nap, and I saw what I thought was a tent in the distance up high on Everest. So I was going to crawl into this destroyed tent, and it turns out it was a dead climber. Ugh. So as I got close to him, he was napping in the snow, and he was from Calgary, a guy named Frank Zebart. Yeah. He tried to climb Everest without oxygen, and seeing him there kept me going. So it was a battle, but it was absolutely one of my top trips, other than the death I saw up there and team members that I lost and all the typical stuff you hear about Everest. It was something special, special place, and the Tibetans are special people.
So how do you, I'm just trying to think how you do that though. Like, I mean, cause there's a balance about dealing with the altitude as you go, but then there's obviously a speed issue too, right? Like, so, I mean, how do you, what's the balance there?
Yeah. So a lot of it's genetics. You don't know if you have the genetics until you get up there, wow. Right? There's some speculation that climbers that can climb without oxygen even have a slightly different sized opening in the base of your skull that allows fluid to drain into your spinal column with pressure builds up in your skull. Mm. There's been some speculation that those of us that can survive at those altitudes without oxygen may have that modification, which is just luck. So I don't know how much weight I put on that, but a lot of it is the preparation I did ahead of time. And then while I was there, even at base camp, I'd go off on my own, sneak into the nearby mountains and climb these peaks all around Everest Base Camp. And these peaks are like, we're talking 6,000 meter high peaks right there. Yeah. They'd be the highest peaks in North America, higher than the highest peaks in North America. So right around sort of the foothills of Everest are these massive mountains. So I was always pushing myself to acclimatize and build up the additional capillaries and hemoglobin and what was required for my body to adapt to altitude. And I had such a good adaptation process or acclimatization process that eventually my team would make bets with other teams that I could beat their Sherpas up to different camps if we left at the same time. So that is more a testament to my preparation than anything else. So when I did get into position at high camp, which is at about 8,300 meters above sea level, I felt really confident that I was going to be able to do without O's, as we say in climbing. So, and I did, but, you know, I paid a small price, but, three fingers, but guys on my, I lost a team member the next night. He was camped right beside me. I gave him a cup of tea before he left and he's still up there. Yeah. We lost a guy from a heart attack at base camp and you are seeing dead climbers just like me all over the mountain. You pass them. It's a very sobering experience, but it's what happens in high altitude mountaineering.
I mean, you're clocking every one of those guys you see, though, aren't you? Mentally, like that's got to have a.
Enough. Oh yeah, and you go, that guy's. There's no difference between him and I. Like he's got a wife and kids at home. He left a job. He did this and. Yeah, it's really sad. And they're, but at the moment, it's probably like being in war where you don't, it's not like when you drive by a bad car accident on the highway, you're really hit hard and you're in shock and you're just flabbergasted by what you're seeing. Yeah. When you're up in the mountain, it's like you see it and you keep.
I just did a Remembrance Day podcast not long ago and had an account from a Métis guy from Manitoba about landing at D-Day on Juno Beach. And it sounded very similar. It's just like I had to get to a pillbox and my buddies were dropping all around me. And I just knew my mission was to get to that spot. You know? So it sounds... it's a hyper-focus thing, isn't it? It's
hyper-focus, but the only difference between him and I is the fact that he's doing something heroic and I'm doing something rather stupid that I paid money to do. So big difference.
That's pretty heroic. Yeah,
to mention me and D-Day, let's not do that. Dumb day maybe for me.
No, pretty incredible thing. So I want to touch on some trips you've done in the Canadian North too. And I know that's a big part of your career because you fly for Canadian North Airlines, right?
Yep.
But you, I mean, sadly you lost a son up there about a decade ago, right? Yeah.
Yeah, 9 years ago, yep.
Yeah. And you did a canoe trip with your younger son to honor his loss. Can you just tell us that story?
Sure. So our oldest boy, Richard, followed in my footsteps and became a pilot as well. And he got his first job at Norman Wells in the Northwest Territories, which is on the Mackenzie River. So picture halfway between Yellowknife and Inuvik. And he was excited. I was excited. I still remember my first job as a bush pilot. There's nothing like it. Best days of my life. And he arrived in Norman Wells and started his career with Northright Airways in Norman Wells. Flying in what's called the Soctu region. And he started to date a girl that was from Ontario that was spending her summer up there off university to work at a hotel as a server and a waitress. And he showed up at her place of work one night and around 9:30 at night, they decided they were going to go canoeing. And it's for Southern Canadians, 9:30 at night is still full daylight in the summer in the Arctic, bright daylight. And they went down to the Mackenzie. They grabbed a canoe. They were just sort of paddling around just offshore by about 20 meters. And sort of as a background, Richard had been canoeing before with me. We'd done some whitewater. We did some canoe survival training and rescue training and how to rescue people from canoes, etc. He was an experienced paddler. Mm. And they, as most 21-year-olds would do, didn't put life jackets on. And just off 20 meters off the shore, a wave entered the boat. They laughed about it because the girl survived, so I know the story. And then another wave hit, and the boat capsized. So initially, they stayed with the boat, and then Richard stayed with it because it wasn't his boat, I think is why he did it. Mm-hmm. And she started to swim for shore. And just by luck, there was somebody having a conversation with his wife at a friend's house, standing outside the house for privacy on their back deck, which was overlooking the river. And he heard them yelling for help. And he, with superhuman strength, was able to hook up his trailer, which he could not do normally by himself, lift it onto the trailer hitch of his truck, and roar down to the river and race out there with his partner. And the first person they saw was this young lady. They grabbed her, spun the boat around, and they saw Richard hanging out of the canoe. And then they got there, and he was gone. So I got that phone call that every Canadian parent doesn't want to get from the RCMP at 2:30 in the morning, and it turned our life upside down.
Yeah.
So the next year, Rich's little brother Eric and I went up to Delaunay on Great Bear Lake, this beautiful village in the Northwest Territories, and we the locals there gave us a canoe. They treated us with kindness and respect and honor, and we canoed the Great Bear River to the Mackenzie, and then the Mackenzie and the Norman Wells as a way to, I don't know, be closer to it, to try and, you know, be closer to Richard, to deal with it. Mm-hmm. That's how we did it.
Yeah.
So really special.
Yeah.
Very special.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can, you know, hear the emotion still now, but
yeah.
Was there a sense of release in doing that too, in terms of connecting to him?
I mean,
again?
In a sense, I guess there is. You never get over it, mm-hmm. but you are able to obviously continue on. I mean, tragedy is something that will touch everybody. Generally though, in Western societies, we don't lose our kids before our time is up. And so when it's out of sequence like that, and a 21-year-old young man sort of at the peak of his abilities and his whole future ahead of him, it's extra bitter and tragic. And but, you know, life goes on, and you Janet and I describe it as post-traumatic growth. You actually you can either decide to let it keep you completely submerged, or you can fight like hell to try and live a normal life and talk about it openly and remember him. So that's what we do. And as a side note, Eric, now the little brother, has now become a pilot. Yeah. He flies for Canadian North now, up out of he lives in Yellowknife, so he's back in the north. So
beautiful. Tell me about the north. Like, what is it about the north? You've been flying up there almost your whole career, I think, right? I mean, what is it that keeps you there?
I mean, it's one of these things. It's like saying you don't know what you don't know until you've been up there, which most Canadians don't go to the north. To me, it's a real shame. I think we should almost have a federal program where we do exchanges into the north.
Yeah. I had a teacher in university. I did a course on the Canadian North, and if, like, the first week he's like, okay, and it's a room of 60 people, right? He's like, who in here has been to Florida? And literally everyone hands up. Who here has been north of 60? And like two people. And he's like, this is your country, people. Like, get up there.
And it's also the majority of your country's up there when it comes to landmass.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain. It's the landscapes. It's the people. It is the wildlife. I love big empty places on maps. Mm-hmm. And so it definitely has that.
Yeah.
And once you see it, you'll know why I love it. And the Southerners that I've sent up there, meaning the Southern Canadians that I've sent up there on passes, for example, they're all enamored with it and they talk about it forever. Yeah. And it takes a special type of person to live in the Canadian Arctic. When it's minus 45 degrees, you may have just a few hours of very dim light every day from the sun just peeking above the horizon. It's tough. It's a tough environment, but then you're paid back with these summers of 24-hour daylight and this explosion of life because summers are so short up there and the vast number of lakes and rivers and mountains and unnamed lakes. And, you know, when I look out the window of my jet flying across the Arctic at these places, it just, I want to go there. Like, I want to go, what is down there? Like, and I've done that. Like, we were doing charters up to Alert, which is the northern tip of Ellesmere Island. It's a Canadian Forces base up there.
You can't go further north than that, really, basically.
You can't, no. And 800K from the North Pole. And I looked down at this really spectacular remote mountain range on Ellesmere. I ended up going back there because the highest peak in Nunavut's up there. It's called Barbo Peak. And my buddy and I dragged a sled across the tundra. We'd sew them up with stainless steel wire every night because the tundra and the rocks are eating the sleds. And then eventually we got to the glaciers and we skied up there and we climbed this thing. And 3 o'clock in the morning, we were ripping down these glaciers at 3 o'clock in the morning with sunglasses on and sunscreen. It was just amazing.
Yeah, beautiful.
And then you wake up to your tent in the morning on the tundra and there'd be a herd of muskox around you or Arctic hares. Yeah. Amazing.
That's the thing too up there is I think as a southerner the tendency is to think it's just a desert, right? And there's nothing there, but it's so like Ellesmere's teeming with wildlife, isn't it?
Yeah, it's I saw Perry caribou, so one of the rarest caribou on earth, a small little high Arctic caribou, and most astonishingly there used to be the term we use for the northern people are Inuit, but there was a population of what they call Thule Eskimo that lived up there. So these are these Neolithic Eskimo that lived on Ellesmere Island. And their speculation, they may never have discovered fire and that they may have spent the winters in these stone houses, I would even call them a house, a heap of rocks, and basically went into a type of hibernation, just sitting there shivering all winter long. And they lived largely off of Arctic hare and fox that they would catch in these stone traps.
Amazing.
Where basically they have a rock propped up on they build a conical tower of rock with a rock propped up and type a little bit of bait. When the fox went in there, it would trigger the rock to close over top, and the fox, and that's what they'd eat. I mean, it's you find little tiny arrowheads there, and really, to think that there are people that would spend 3 months in darkness every winter and survive up there just shows you how tough we are. So, an amazing place.
Yeah, and the Inuit are so adapted to that place. Like, they are of that place in a way that you and I aren't,
just,
really, you know?
Like, just like the Tibetans and the Sherpa are of high-altitude environments.
Yeah. I was just in Tulluk Rock in Nunavut, and it was October, so it was like minus 20. It wasn't crazy cold. But I'm like outside sort of with kids out there playing street hockey, and no one's wearing gloves. And I'm like, it's not cold. And I'm like, oh my God, you know?
Yeah. I mean, they're amazing people, but they're also going through, there's so much so many social issues out there now. It's a, and I don't know what, you know, there's an epidemic of obesity and of diabetes and all these southern diseases. Mm-hmm. That have been, I guess, transported up there by us. And you take a population that lived off of what they call country food, which is wildlife.
Yeah.
And now it's far easier to grab a bag of chips or pop. And pop is cheaper than milk. And, you know, you're looking at $10 or $12 for 4 liters of milk, or $15 or $50 for a watermelon, or tomatoes are, you know, $3 a piece. So of course people have to go to what they can afford.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of issues in the north, along with the beauty.
Yeah. I have to say, the communities I visited, what always impresses me is the people who are pushing the whole back to the land. Like, let's figure it out. And this is who we are. And this is how we live up here. This is what we're built to do, you know? So,
and there are programs up there to try and get the youth now off of their phones and off of the TVs and into the bush, not the bush, but into the tundra and hunt and fish and dry char and do all that stuff.
And really, don't we need that everywhere? Like, really, you know?
Do we ever?
Yeah.
Do we ever?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think these things are, are deadly. And I think we...
Smartphones, yeah.
And people are using it to babysit their kids now. And, you know, and when I do my talks and I'm talking to a group of young people, I do public speaking and I tell them that, you know, life is in your hands. It's not in your hand.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And this constant dopamine hit we're getting from these things. And,
yeah.
And when I used to have to go through the pages of National Geographic or Life magazine or Farley Mode book and imagine, you know, him coming up to a wolf den and getting snarled at by the female wolf, etc. And I had to visualize how that was. Now I can look at Instagram and find it immediately.
Yeah.
And get that, you know, without having to use my imagination or put any effort into it.
The flip side is I did a canoe trip up the Wind River up to Fort McPherson with a cousin of mine and my son. And, you know, it's 2018, so middle of the Trump presidency. So for the first couple of days, we were, you know, just complaining about politics. And then the phones weren't working anymore. So we had no new material, right? And eventually we just stopped talking about it. And good Lord, wasn't that so much better? You know, like...
Fort McPherson, that's a beautiful country. I've ridden the Dempster Highway in the wintertime from Tuck to Dawson City. So I started in Tuck, rode across the sea ice before the road was complete to Inuvik. And then I rode with studded tires on all the way down to Dawson City. It was an amazing trip.
Yeah.
Amazing trip.
I've only done the Dempster Highway in summer, but that is one of the most spectacular stretches of road you can find anywhere in the world. Like literally, just stunning.
And I took Andrea and Richard, our two oldest kids, the boy we lost, but when they were 11 and 13, we rode it from Dawson City to Inuvik in the summertime, and they're still the youngest people to ever ride that road.
Nice. Nice.
On bicycles, just camping on the way. It was amazing. Yeah. It's one of the most spectacular roads. So like you said, David, if you have the opportunity, go up there. You don't have to necessarily bike it, but you can drive it or motorcycle it or whatever. Blow your mind.
Yeah, it's super accessible. Absolutely. So before I let you go, and thank you for all your time, but I always ask people to name a favorite place in Canada. Like, it might be a happy place you go to in your mind when you're dealing with stress, or I don't know, a place you just love to be at, or, you know, what would that place be for you?
Anytime that I'm in the backcountry, I don't care if it's Kananaskis country, I don't care if it's the Gatineau Hills trail running with my brother on an October day where the leaves are bright red, or if it's on... it's up in the high Arctic, standing on the shore of the Arctic Ocean, fishing for char. It's to me, it's when I'm with my kids. That's when it's the best.
Yeah.
And those are my favorite times. So any iconic Canadian landscape with my family, then you've got it. That's the winner for me. It doesn't have to be standing on top of some challenging peak. It can just be getting the time in the outdoors where what we talked about are turned off. And it's just you and the kids and enjoying the scenery. To me, those are my favorite places.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, Laval, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the Explore podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for giving me the time to chat, David.
Yeah, real pleasure. And it's a real pleasure having all of you joining us in these conversations episode after episode. And thanks, of course, to everyone who donated, everyone who took part in the RCGS Polar Plunge. We literally could not do this podcast without you. Thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. And a reminder, if you like this podcast, tell somebody else about it. Recommend it to a friend. It helps bring more people to these conversations. Until next time, when we'll explore again, I'm David McGuffin.
I think right now we're enjoying very much looking back at the Earth, and it's just a fantastic experience, and I just can't wait to get back and start telling people.
We left Simpson about June 10th with a fur brigade consisting of a number of York boats. Each man by 10 voyageurs.
For us Inuit, it means that Inuit oral history is very strong.
And we flew low over every inch of the country that it could be. We were hoping that he would fire at us.
Oh, I guess 160 dives or so. There are shrimp fish swimming around outside. It's just fabulous here.
Well, I'm a first for Canada.